So thank you for giving me the opportunity to tell you about these developments and kind of continuation of Niklas' talk. And in fact, it's really rather complimentary, since most of the time I will talk about the gauge side, which I just didn't get to, even though he also contributed huge amounts to our understanding of that subject. And nevertheless, the string theory is always sort of in behind of much of what I'm saying. And in fact, much of, I think, we are now in the situation that, at least from our point of view, it's not completely clear yet that things really will work out in the sense of a complete matching. But what is for sure is that having this correspondence, even though we don't quite know how it really works, is extremely inspiring for making progress on both sides of this ADS-CFT duality. So I'm kind of starting where Niklas left it yesterday, and I'll just present you one rather recent result. And then, if you don't understand everything technically about you know how this is derived, it's really just a little preview, and then I'll explain you actually what I mean by S matrix and beta ansatz and so on and so forth. So, we heard yesterday that there's this kind of structure which looks rather similar, but then there's so-called discrepancies. But of course, it's not really a discrepancy necessarily in the sense what we already discussed about yesterday, because it's a different region of coupling constant space. And in fact, I think one rather intriguing idea is that, do you have a pointer, by the way? One rather intriguing idea is that maybe somehow you can go from the structures you find at string theory to the structures you find at gauge theory and vice versa by some idea that somehow these S matrices, which somehow describe the spectrum, dress up when you go from weak to strong coupling. And that's something that sort of generically happens very often in condensed matter, that if you have an integrable system with different regimes, then the integrable structure stays completely intact. But the details of the S matrix might change. And a famous example is this XXX chain, where you have a ferromagnetic phase and an antiferromagnetic phase. And the actual S matrix for the degrees of freedom for the antiferromagnet, which are called spin-ons, is different from the one for the excitations of the ferromagnets, the magnons. But the two are precisely related in such a fashion. So that is one idea. It's not clear whether it works, but for the moment, it's not excluded. So anyway, let me come to this preview. So recently, there has been a many-year effort to compute three-loop anomalous dimensions of leading twist operators in QCD, which is very important for understanding actually experimentally deep inelastic scattering. And in fact, the business was, of course, started by David Gross. And now it's really important to know it to high loop order to explain experiments, as I understand. So let me just show you how this result they get after really a huge effort, spent many years. The final result. Sort of looks like this. It's an excerpt from their paper. So I just want to, that's where it starts, and it continues. And so that's the three loop result. And that's actually, so now Lipatov came along, and he's been doing this for a very long time, has been in this business. And he has this incredible intuition that somehow he kind of has an expectation for n equals 4. And this expectation is called some sort of transcendentality principle. And it's somehow related to things which I'm trying to learn but don't quite understand. I mean, this relation between EPF, KL, and DGLAP. So actually, funny relations between high energy scattering and inelastic scattering. And somehow, based on all this experience, when this paper came out last year, he kind of looked at it. And he has this idea that in n equals 4, somehow only contributions of so-called highest transcendentality should contribute. And that's if you add up these indices, the magnitude of these indices of these harmonic sums here, you find numbers which are range from 1 to 5 at three loops. And this transcendentality principle means that at three loops, you should have only things which exactly add up to 5. These are harmonic sums. So they are defined. I'll show you a little bit bigger. It's a little hard to read. I'll show you in a second how they are defined. Well, they are. I'll show you in a second what they are. So, anyways, and basically by just dropping everything that where the indices don't add up, end up to 5. No, but that's really what I talked to him. That's what he did. So he came up with some prediction for the n equals 4. Yeah. So his prediction then is that so that's David's result one loop. And that's a two-loop result, which is known since a few years ago. Actually, I think it was first worked out by Lipatov. And that's his prediction based on this QCD. And here's a definition of the harmonic sums. So in fact...
You don't have something in parentheses, it's capital S is infinity?
What do you mean? Capital S is a spin. I mean, I didn't really say what tell you what in n equals 4. So these in the n equals 4 language, these twist operators would be operators that have a sort of a few meta fields and then lots and lots of covariant derivatives, and the number of the meta fields is called the twist. So the simplest thing you can have is twist 2, which is 2 meta fields, and then this is a space time spin here. Number of covariant derivatives, and that can be arbitrary. So that's the S appearing in the harmonic sums. Okay, and now, I'll show you, we can sort of guess a Bethe ansatz, putting together ideas from string theory and this integrable gauge theory, which.
This is just a conjecture you said because the
The Feynman diagrams for n equals 4 have not been properly added up at three loops for these twist operators. There's this funny thing that the QCD has really different fields. Right? It has more stuff, which is you can get rid of, but it's somehow appearing in loops in principle. And then n equals 4 has stuff that QCD doesn't. But somehow there must be some kind of hidden non-renormalization theorem working at work here. It says that only sort of these diagrams that give the leading this highest transcendentality terms contribute in n equals 4, and the rest kind of cancels. And those also appear in QCD. Oh yeah, that is really. This result is really proven. This result is really proven. I mean, Lipatov and Belizean, I think I don't know exactly who was in this group, but they really did the computation for n equals 4 here. But the computation has not been done for three loops. So now, but there's a check. I mean, because there's also Kanishi field. It's a spin 2 here, and that agrees with there recently was a computation for Kanishi to three loop, and that agrees with this. So anyway, what did I want to say? Yeah, so with this beta Andersen, which I'll explain you now in this lecture how to guess, you can indeed reproduce this three loop result. So that's also a kind of a conjecture, of course. But as far as I can see, the conjectures entering into Lippertoff's stuff and the conjectures entering in our stuff are rather distinct. So
assumptions that you put into the lip-on-less?
Well, this will be most of the lecture. You have to listen to this for 1 hour. So I'll just give you some flavor of what sort of results you can get from it. And in fact, it's very difficult to use these beta equations and actually prove this. And I haven't quite succeeded yet. We're working on this, but I suddenly checked it for many, many spins, up to spin 70. And then you get rational numbers like this, and they agree between beta and that and harmonic sum, so, you know. Anyway.
We also get more than in the configuration than the 12.2.
Hmm? We can also do any twist.
Yeah.
And there's one test, two loop test for twist 3, which was done by Burkhard Eden, and it also agrees with our with data on that. Yeah, you have to contract, but there's sort of only one state here. There's only one state here in twist 2. So then you can do even more because in a recent paper with Niklas, we actually then and that again this will feature prominently in this talk, how to get to guess such things. We kind of guessed some for loop on that. And here it is. It sort of looks like a beta, and that's something to the L, right? And then something that scatters. Yeah, I'll explain these things. But then now you can use this Ansatz and try to get higher loops results, which are not known at all. And then something really interesting happens. It's very, very interesting also to take the large S limit of these harmonic sums. And that is also very important because there's also this conjecture that to any loop order, and in fact even non-perturbatively, it just goes like a log S times something. And that was actually even on the string side, this was also confirmed. In ADS-CFT, but then it's not analytic in lambda, there's a square root lambda involved. But it's kind of, it's really, there's lots of Feynman diagrams which have sort of arbitrary powers of logs, and they all cancel. So this is some very funny thing about this theory, that somehow the higher logs cancel. And then there's this principle of, Lippertoff's principle of transcendentality, which also has a reverberation at large S, because then all these harmonic sums can be expressed to zeta functions. And then from what I told you, that the indices of the harmonic sums add up to some constant highest value, it means that you get a prediction that the coefficient, perturbative coefficient in front of the log, should be basically, I mean, here it's just 1, I mean 4, and then it's zeta 2, zeta 4, zeta 6, and in fact, it has to be such that there's only zeta functions here, such that the indices of the zeta function add up to the loop number, I mean, twice the loop number. And you see what's very interesting here, it actually, so this is now a completely new prediction based on Niklas and Ansatz, in preparation with Burkhard Eden, how to do this computation. It's not so easy to extract it from the data. So you see that here, I mean, it's 3 plus 3 is 6, right? And it's actually the first time it can happen here. That's three level, that's one loop, two loop. free loop. Minus two, sorry, The transcendental principle means then that in this large S limit, that the coefficient is just a linear combination of sums of products of zeta functions such that at each term, all the arguments of the zeta function add up to 2 times the loop number minus 2. Yeah, that would be, that's 5 loops, that's 6 loops. So 3 plus 5 and 3 plus 3, so that's zeta 2. So 3 plus, normally it's known that zeta 2n can be expressed as pi, right? I mean, zeta 2 is pi squared, zeta 4 is pi to the 4, and so on. But the odd ones cannot be expressed as pi. And they cannot, and you see at forloop really this thing appears. It cannot appear before because, I mean, just it's basically all the partitions appear. But it's easy to understand that it cannot happen because, for example, here another partition would be 3, 1. But S of 1, so the zeta of 1 is logarithmically divergent, and this would be a log squared. That's not allowed. So these two things go together, the fact that there's no higher logs and the transcendentality principle. So, and the coefficients are rational numbers, yeah. No, but I mean, that's what actually the way I want to put it is that actually we don't know that. So we don't. So what was I going to say about this? Starting, we kind of have a proof for our beta ansatz in some sense. Well, actually, not even for SL2, but it's pretty solid, the three loops here. But 4 and 5 and so on is, of course, really a conjecture. And in fact, there is, as Lucy said, this is very short spin chain. So in principle, it should be affected by wrapping. And I'm not saying that this is actually the correct result, but what I'm saying is that our ansatz is pretty close to reality, at least, because it's very magically, and when you do the computation, you see this, it's really amazing that all the wrong zetas cancel. And it's built in. I mean, it's not built in, it comes out from the ansatz. Okay. So something is going on here. And by the way, also there's a connection to this twister approach, because Byrne, Dixon, and Smirnov, looking at some four-point functions, we're able to also confirm this large S limit of the Lippertov prediction. Is again a different approach based on this this twister activity. And I mean, Zvi told me that they might be able to do the for loop with this approach. And that might be actually maybe our most realistic guess to test some of these conjectured beta and that's to more than three loops, but anyway. Oh yeah, Lippertov conjectured this. But what I'm saying is that this guest beta ansatz just reproduce that. They're consistent.
And Lippertov just guessed it based on something.
Yeah, you have to ask Lippertov.
So if you go back in order 6, you can combine zeta 6 and zeta 2 cubed in the same term.
No, but zeta of odd numbers is not pi.
No, zeta 6.
Yeah.
Is pi 6.
That's right.
And zeta 2 cubed
is also pi 6. Yeah. There's a combination. You're right. It's a combination of zeta. So whenever I saw even, I just put pi. So anyway, I this was just the warm up. So now the talk starts. So anyway, let me assume that everybody knows what it's n equal 4. Let me also assume that it's by now rather familiar how the dilatation operator philosophy, so that there's this mixing problem for the composite operators, and that an elegant way to resolve the mixing is by studying the dilatation operator. In fact, there's a spectral problem here where you study the eigenvalue problem for the dilatation operator, and then these eigenvalues are the anomalous dimensions. And of course, that's what I just said. So it's very useful actually to expand the dilatation operator itself in powers of the coupling constant. So that's the relation between the tree I just had and the usual Toft coupling. And in fact, the dilatation operator philosophy is not restricted to planarity, but when you work out the actual structure of the dilatation operator, there's a planar part and a non-planar part. And it was the discovery of Minahan and Zarembo in 2002 that this planar part of the dilatation operator is nothing but the Hamiltonian of an XXX spin chain. I'll explain in a second what that is. And then these double trace operators would be there when you start one over n corrections. And as I said, the dilatation operator, say, is known. So you could study string splitting and trace splitting and turning and so on. But integrability actually is broken there. But it should be important for the future. Because it's related to a computation of correlation functions in integrable models. So why is this then this XXX spin chain in this famous example of two bosons? So the way it works is that you have these Z fields and the X field, two of the complex scalars. And then when you look at some operators with lots of Z's and some X's, you see that the action of the dilatation operator such that it shifts the X field a little bit to the left and to the right, according to a Lattice-Laplacian law. And that's precisely the Hamiltonian of a spin chain, XXX spin chain. Yeah?
The term should have G squared, Well,
you know, there's this business that it's dynamic and actually there's odd terms and so on and so forth. So that, but let me not get into these details. It has odd powers in the dilatation operator. That's this Heisenberg chain, which just sort of 2 years after quantum mechanics was. So that's just the state space. There's the tensor product of C2, spin up, spin down. The simplest model for a metal, when you think of each such C2 as an atom which can have spin up or down. And the simplest Hamiltonian you can write down for to study the magnetism of such a metal is this Heisenberg Hamiltonian with spin-spin nearest neighbor interactions. So you have to diagonalize this Hamiltonian. And then this is just if the spin chain has length L, involves diagonalizing a 2 to the L by 2 to the L matrix. And it's very easy. So the actual Heisenberg model then we will study as a one-dimensional case where we have a sort of one-dimensional metal. And then you can rewrite this Hamiltonian by just playing a bit with these sigma Pauli matrices in this 1 minus permutation form of nearest neighbors, which is precisely what we just had. So then when all spins are up, the Hamiltonian kills the state. So ferromagnetic ground state is the naive ferromagnetic ground state is a good eigenstate. Very much different from the antiferromagnetic ground state if I flip the sign, because then the natural thing would be the nil state, up, down, and so on. But it's actually not an eigenstate. And there is this non-trivial vacuum, but this is kind of a trivial vacuum. Clearly, H conserves number of up and down spins. And I just wrote pictorial this shift to the left and shift to the right pattern. And then there comes this nice idea that you can now look at these down spins in the sea of up spins as particles or magnons, which is the natural excitations of the ferromagnet. And so you can start building states. Say you have a single downspin or X particle you look at this sort of one magnon state where psi is a position space wave function, and that's there was a question yesterday. That's how you start to see what sort of scattering processes we are looking here at, because this is really this hidden space inside the trace where we put the label on the position of these say X field and the C of Z field inside the trace. So it's not at all space-time. It has nothing to do with four-dimensional or ten-dimensional space, but it's really some internal space. And in fact, we hope that this sort of will become world sheet, right? So anyway, then by acting with this Hamiltonian and implementing the shift to the left lattice Laplacian, you find a simple difference equation, which is of course immediately solved by Fourier transform, and this is the following eigenvalue given by this. And that's called the dispersion law. It's a relation between the momentum of this particle x and its energy. And in N-equal sphere, once again, the energy is one loop anomalous dimension here. And p is the variable dual to the position of the x particle inside the trace. So the scattering we are now about to consider is a scattering in this space of traces. World sheet scattering in string language. Okay, and now the beautiful thing is that this XXX system is integrable. So you can make a so-called Bethe-Ansatz, invented by Bethe in 1931. So you look at the two magnon states first, and now you have to distinguish two positions. You can try to make the same plane wave Ansatz. And then you see that immediately the difference equation you obtain for nearly all L1, L2 is solved by this, such that the total energy is now the sum over the individual energies of these two particles. So this is nearly a wave function, but not quite, because there's a special situation when L1 equals L2 minus 1, so then they are nearest neighbors. And then the difference equation is not actually solved for this state. And what you have to actually do, and this was Bethe's idea, you have to sort of add another plane wave with P1 and P2 interchanged with some amplitude here. And fixing the amplitude as a special function of P1 and P2 allows you to really satisfy the difference. So clearly it's still satisfied when L1 and L2 are apart more than one neighbor. But now, when you do some simple algebra for the specific value of the amplitude, it's also satisfied in the nearest neighbor situation. So you have really an eigenstate. And this is called the S matrix, because the nice picture here one can have is that indeed, upon Fourier transforming, the X particles start to move. They are most of the time free, except when they're nearest neighbors. And then they can do two things. They can either go through each other or backscatter, so they can either conserve some momenta or exchange them. But the individual momenta are conserved. So this is these two terms here. What do you mean, how does it look? I mean, the way I define it is just like this, because I don't want to overcount. Because they're indistinguishable, the two particles, so I don't want to overcount. But now comes the real mystery about this. I mean, the amazing thing about integrability, that this simple picture here remains true when I have any number of magnons. Okay, so when you have any number of magnons, you do the same thing. Now there's, let's say we have k magnons, so there's k momenta now. So now I superpose k plane waves with all the k factorial possible ways to permute the momenta. And then the amazing thing is that if you do this by brute force, and you have to work a little, but it's not so hard, and to actually plug this in, you can verify that it's still an eigenstate. This is additive energy, which is still the sum over local dispersions. And then, actually, you find that the ratio of two amplitudes, if you compare two plane waves where just two momenta are interchanged, is precisely this two-body S matrix. Okay. So that's a real beta on that, and it usually doesn't work, but it works for an integrable system. And in 1931, it just wasn't clear why it worked, it just worked. And in some cases, and most of the time, it didn't work. So anyway, and then the actual beta equations you get by imposing on this wave function periodic boundary conditions. So the S matrix is important to say that the S matrix is derived on the infinite system because you need a notion of asymptotic states. And it's sort of satisfied difference equation that's satisfied for any values of some momenta. But if you now impose periodic boundary conditions, they get quantized as always. And then but it's very easy to see from this wave function that you get this the simple laws that one magnon, the phase factor when it circles one magnon around the ring, is given by this simple product of two-body S matrices. So these are the beta equations. So you have to solve the system of equations and find the, now the momenta are constrained. There's exactly k equations. Then you plug into this additive energy expression, and you are done. Now, that's a really sort of the old-fashioned way of doing it. Nevertheless, I explained it in great detail because it is a way that, for the moment, we derive the higher loop beta andersses. There's a much more powerful approach called algebraic beta andersses, which was developed by this Leningrad school. And it really made transparent why it actually works. Not that it works, but why it works. Yeah. What do you mean, some flat space mode?
Yeah.
You also want to take number of flats, right?
I mean, maybe. No, but I mean, so what is nice later we'll see, and I don't know how much we'll see since time goes so fast. But you see in this BMN picture, it's very nice because that is actually precisely the limit where you sort of the system is so big that you neglect the scattering, and then each particle is on its own, and the S matrix is actually one. I mean, you just drop it, and that's the BMN limit. So anyway, there's this more powerful approach, and I'll just race through it because it's. That's a sort of scientific way to do these nearest neighbor spin chains. But for the moment, we don't know how to do this for the long-range systems, unfortunately. So the way it usually works for nearest neighbor models is that you define a so-called R matrix, which you can intuitively think of as some kind of S matrix for the actual physical particles with some test particle. And then this looks like this. So now this R matrix really is a matrix before the S matrix wasn't really a matrix, right? So you have this Young-Baxter equation, which is pictorially, you can write like this, or maybe not, sorry, not everybody sees this. So the sequence of scattering, if you have three particles, doesn't matter, and that's, So then what you do is you having at hand this R matrix, you define a so-called Lux operator, discrete Lux operator from the R matrix, and look at the so-called monodromy when you multiply for length L spin chain L of these Lux operators. And that is really the thing that's very closely related to what Niklas explained to you yesterday in this sigma model, because there we also had this kind of monodromy. So that's a discrete analog of that for spin chains. And then you can immediately see that when you do that you get this so-called, this Young-Baxter intertwining relation for this monodromy involving the R matrix. And then when you take a trace now on this relation, you define a so-called transfer matrix, just like Niklas did yesterday, the classical sigma model. So you take the trace of this monodromy to define the transfer matrix. And then from this Young-Baxter symmetry here, you conclude that this transfer matrix commutes for different values of the spectral parameters. So what is the spectral parameter? That's nothing but
key of view, that's a
have a which A, that trace of A and trace on
that. So the monotomy matrix lives on the tensor product of the spin chain. I mean, the spin chain in quantum space, which is a tensor product of C2s. And then there's one auxiliary space, and one extra space, auxiliary space. So it's a little bit longer spin chain. And it sort of intuitively corresponds to saying that you said, so this is the physical particle of the spin chain, and then you sort of shoot a test party through it. So you have one more particle. And the spectral parameter, the thing with which you test the system, is precisely the momentum of this test particle.
But the trace then is a trace on that extra space.
Yeah, then you eliminate. So that means that you actually close the thing. And then pictorially, what's happening is when you now look at two monodromies, then using Young-Baxter, you prove that this equals the same as this, and therefore when you close it up, these two transfer matrices commute. Well, that's a pictorial proof of what's going on here.
A plus B.
Huh?
A capital A plus capital B. Okay, it's T of U.
No, it's just one auxiliary space. It's a 2x2 in the auxiliary space, the transfer matrix. But I mean, then when I prove this, then I have of course two auxiliary spaces because I now have two transfer matrices. So I have an A and an A prime. So now I have to take two traces. I have to take to get this. I have to take two traces. That's probably what your point. So that's true.
What does it mean? So you wrote this 2x2 matrix upstairs.
Yeah.
A, B, C, D is an operator. On the
so this is an operator in the quantum space of the spin chain, and I wrote it as a matrix in the auxiliary space.
So it means that the trace is capital A of U plus
W. A plus B.
A plus B,
yeah? Yeah? Yes. Right. So anyway, and the nice thing about this thing is now that when you evaluate now, expand this transfer matrix around this very special value of the spectral parameter that is the momentum of the test particle, then, of course, when you expand in U, you get T in U, then you get all charges acting in this quantum space. And because of this law here, they all commute. So you get a complete set of L commuting charges. And these are these hidden charges of the system. And the beautiful thing is, it's not hard to prove, that actually the Hamiltonian, this Heisenberg Hamiltonian, is one out of these charges. So you have a Hamiltonian, you have created the Hamiltonian, and these hidden charges. And then when you actually compute the value of the transfer matrix, you find this expression. You have to now use this Young-Baxter symmetry to derive that.
So you have Q1 and Q2, right?
Yeah.
Lambda, capital lambda, the eigenvalue.
That's the eigenvalue of T. But then it's easy to prove that it should be a polynomial. Yeah, I don't have the time to actually. I'm going fast through this. And then you see that from the original definition, this is a product of Lex operator, should be a polynomial. But this doesn't look like one. So canceling the poles leads to the beta equations. And then when you make this map from U to some variable P, according to the thing, you come back to the good old-fashioned beta equation. So that's the sort of the fancy way of do what beta did, but it really proves, it really makes the structure manifest. And I just mentioned it because somehow we kind of know what to do what beta did for these long-range systems, but we don't know this. So anyway, now of course the N=4 has many more fields. So then you can do the same games. Yeah. You can also find the wave function. And you find, of course, the same result as beta did. So for example, you could insert instead of an X field some fermion, particular fermion, and then when you do that, then things become much simpler, because when you run through this coordinate space beta and you find that then basically this S matrix is one at one loop. And that means that the k-body wave function is much simpler than the beta wave function. It's just a Slater determinant. And that was noticed by Colin Heckman, McLaughlin, and Swanson. So the beta equation is really, I mean, there's no scattering here. It's a free system. And this is actually some version of the XY model. So there's even simpler cases hidden in this n equals 4. But then there's also cases there which are very important. And in fact, now I'm coming back to what I said in the beginning. So for example, when we come back to these twist operators, so meta field with covariant derivatives, then this is actually an integrable, still an integrable spin XXX SL2 Heisenberg spin chain, but now the spin is negative, minus 1/2. And the Hamiltonian, so that, what does this mean? That means that now sort of the vacuum is Z, tensor product of the Z, but now we still have bosonic excitations, but now you can have more than one excitation on a site because you can have more than one covariant derivative acting on a given scalar field. In fact, you can have arbitrarily many. And that's related to the fact that this negative representations of SL2 are infinite dimensional, arbitrarily high excitations. But the price you pay is that actually, since you have arbitrarily many configurations now, you need arbitrarily many rules for shifting them around. And that was also found by this Leningrad school. This is this, the psi function enters into these rules here, and that's the derivative of the logarithmic derivative of the gamma function. And so when you do the coordinate space beta ansatz, you find almost the same result as for the SU2 case, but with the power to the minus one. But to actually really prove it is much harder now, and to actually prove the coordinate beta ansatz is trickier. I mean, I didn't sit down to try to do this because you have to deal with all these special configurations and show that with these intricate rules, it still factorizes the problem. But and here you come really to this algebraic beta ansatz becomes really powerful. You can really construct it for any representation, and actually also for any group and so on, any supergroup, as long as it's nearest neighbor. The construction is a bit more involved before, and in fact, you start needing, I don't have time now to explain, you need two types of transfer matrices. One which gives you the beta equation, and one that gives you the Hamiltonian. And sort of everything commutes in the end with everything, so the thing that gives the beta equation, the thing that generates the Hamiltonian, and well, before in this algebraic beta, and it gives you the beta equations, but it also constructs the Hamiltonian. And in fact, all the charges, yeah. You need two kinds of transfer matrices, yeah, because it's I don't have time to explain it. It has something to do with some. I mean, and basically, it's still simplest to use a spin 1/2 test particle. So there's one kind of Lux operator, which, as before, where you just add the size of the matrix of the quantum space, but you leave the auxiliary space dimensions the same, and that gives you, in an easy fashion, the beta equation. And then the funniest thing is, and we are kind of in this situation, by the way, in our long-range models, then you get beta equations, but you don't have a Hamiltonian. So now, when you want a Hamiltonian, yeah, they are kind of not cannot be used for they generate charges, but they are not, the Hamiltonian is not within them in this set. Yeah, so they are non-local, and in fact they kind of don't, yeah. And the physical transfer matrix you obtain by actually using as an auxiliary space a matrix of the same size as the representation of the spin you look at. So for spin one quantum space, the matrices are analog of Pauli radius are 3/3, and then you use for the auxiliary space also 3/3. And here we have to use infinite by infinite, right? Because it's negative. And then when you do that, you can construct the Hamiltonian. You can see from here that it's really much easier to get the beta equation in integrable systems than to get construct the Hamiltonian.
What is the meaning of that inverse? So what is
What do you mean? So that's the S matrix. So that's just the fact that before we had U1 minus U2 plus I over U1 minus U2 minus I, and now it's 1 over that. From spin 1 half plus 1 half to spin minus 1 half. That's what we need to do when we want to study this twist operator, as opposed to the SU2 sector of Minahan and Zarambo.
Do we have other schemes? Is there a need to
do other schemes? Yeah, that's sure.
So you have the same momentum here. It states again that we have the same momentum.
Yeah, you can. That's fine.
I'm still confused about the answer to Juan's question. The SU2 S matrix is 4 by 4.
No, sorry. This was the R matrix. This is S matrix in the factor, the ratio of amplitudes in the position space wave function. It was just a factor, you see? But now, if you want matrices, here they are. So now you can look, put together, for example, this SU2 system and the SU1/1 system. And well, I'm somehow I have to take some short. I'm going to have to take some shortcuts. So maybe I'll just say that when you now have two types of excitations, the fermions and the other, I mean, the boson that's not a background boson. And now when the things scatter, you can really see the ordering. And before they were indistinguishable. Yeah, now they become distinguishable. So now the S matrix really becomes a matrix. And So now, when you work it out here, you'll find such a structure that indeed satisfies the Young-Baxter equation. And it looks like the R matrix for SU2, but now this is SU2/1, the S matrix of SU2/1. And now there's a little bit complicated procedure to get the beta equations. It's called nested beta and that, because when you write the beta equations now with this S matrix, since now the S matrix is really a matrix, you're not done after imposing periodic boundary conditions. You still have a huge, this is a tensor product of two-body S matrices, which is still a huge matrix. So you have to diagonalize again. You're only half done. And that was discovered by Young. What you do is you do another beta and that, to now solve this problem, which leads actually to a shorter diagonalization of a shorter spin chain, where you've kicked out the background field and chosen a new background field. And then, roughly speaking, you get two beta equations from the eigenvalue from the first one, and then the second one really sort of describes the scattering of that's going on in this shorter spin chain. So you start to get the system of equations. And then you can, in this TJ case, and then the whole thing is now for n equals 4, you have to label all these excitations with Dynkin diagrams of SU2,2/4. And roughly speaking, if you have some state, you have to put excitations on this Dynkin diagram, with, like additional labels to tell you what you have. So now all the particles carry momentum, but they carry additional labels, group labels. And now now there's a scattering sort of going on both for the momenta but also for the labels. And the scattering of the labels goes essentially according to the Cartan matrix and its nearest neighbor on the Dynkin diagram for one loop. So anyway, the upshot when you do now the nested beta ansatz is that you find now 7 equations according to the 7 types of labels you need here.
So in the spin chain, you have a representation instead of C2 in the Heisenberg case.
Yeah. It's infinite dimensional, of course. It's infinite dimensional.
A representation of SU2.
Yeah, so it's an infinite.
Now, what is this exchange of hopping on the Dynkin diagram? Is that how I'm changing representation?
Yeah, I don't have time to explain it. But basically, you're nearest neighbor still means that you look at adjacent sites. Yeah. So you have to multiply them, look at the decomposition,
yes.
and figure out the rules for shifting in all possible ways the labels from one side to the other and vice versa. I mean, shifting around the labels on these two adjacent sites.
But those are just labels of representations, right?
Yeah.
But you have to actually map states within the representation.
I don't understand the question. And
if I have two adjacent spins, yeah. I have a vector and one representation.
Yeah. It's easy to let's go back to this SL2 case where we had covariant derivatives, right? Then it's an infinite dimensional representation. So you have two sites and the nearest neighbor model. So you could have any number, let's say there's a total number of S excitations, covariant derivatives, so it could be S1 on one side and S2 on the other. So now the Hamiltonian can shift any amount of S1s on the other side and any of CS2 on the other side. And that was actually, that's why I wrote you this Hamiltonian before with the psi function. It gives you all the possible routes to do that.
You're actually working in components. There's actually routes that will be around, not entire representations.
Okay. So this is actually some kind of matrix on the root lattice on the quantum. So two routes are
on the space.
Well, now I'm lost. I mean, so the state space is on.
You need rules. You need the rules for mapping an arbitrary configuration on one side to the other, right? And of course you shouldn't overcount it where you should representation.
So I have a vector in one representation at site one, and a vector in another representation at site one.
Yeah. And then you look what you possibly can get.
How also I get a mapping on.
Yeah.
Change.
Right. Yeah, that it's essentially that's a lift. You have to, and it takes a while to. It's a lecture in itself. Nicholas worked out the complete one loop dilatation operator by explaining in general when you have the two adjacent sites. What are these rules? Actually, even on planarly, to shift these labels from one to the other, and then magically. I mean, you can argue that then basically you can see that the idea is that you look at the tensor product, at all the possible way of what you can get, and then there's an unknown coefficient, and there's this beautiful idea of the lift that actually by going back to SL2, the case where you can prove independently that you have this psi function, that's enough to fix you these unknown coefficients. So together with working out the SL2 case and group theory, you can find it for the general system.
So why do you know in advance it's integrable or integrable also?
No. Then it comes to the other steps that you have to prove that it's integrable. So you have to show that it can be obtained. This is construction I showed you before, that it can be obtained as a derivative of an R matrix. No. These are the actual beta equations in the very end of the day are the completely diagonalized thing. So that's the end. You remember I explained this here. This is the beta equations. And then you have this nesting procedure. No, that's a Cartan matrix. That describes the scattering between the different flavors. It's a very short way. Well, because I wrote it very general, you can also put the different representations for the vacuum. You can pick, for example, Z as a vacuum, but you can choose other vacua. In fact, in the superspin channel, there's many ways to choose a vacuum. So there's also an ambiguity. You get completely different looking, depending on what you choose for vacuum, different looking beta equations. But then they all give you the same spectrum. So so how much more time do I have?
How much more time do you need?
Well, I did about 2/3 of my talk. Well, you just leave if you get bored. Because anyway, that's kind of old stuff from 2 years ago. Now I come to the little bit. That's also kind of old, but. So anyway, the upshot of that was that somehow now at one loop we have this spin chain, I mean, this original observation of Winner and Zarembo lifts to the whole thing, and the whole thing is one loop integrable. But still, it wouldn't be so useful if it wasn't true more generally. And now comes this point that it's actually true beyond one loop. And again, the way to check it is first in SU2, where go back to SU2, and you can work out the dilatation operator by looking at the Feynman diagrams. You find this, and then with some assumptions that I don't want to get into, you can find the three loop thing. And later, this expansion was actually proven by Niklas in his thesis. So what you see is from this dilatation operator is that it actually starts, it's still a spin chain, but it becomes more and more non-local. At two loop, you start get also next nearest neighbor interactions, at three, next, next, and so on. And also, there's multi spin terms appearing, which is a bit nasty.
What is that number of types? What is that number of spins?
The number of sites is not. But in this case, it is. I'm trying to be pedagogical. It's SU2. So here. It's a very tiny subsector. Yeah. It's SU2 within SU224. So, but then the funny thing is, then when you now see how the charges of the one loop magnet deform you see that they still bother loop order by loop order, as far as you can check, commute. Of course, just like the Hamiltonian gets corrected, the charges get corrected. There exist deformations, but that's right. But you can, I mean, again, it's a long story here. You can really argue, you can see in the spectrum that there is, I mean, these charges create actually certain degeneracies in the spectrum, and you can really see by looking, just by analyzing Hamiltonian by brute force, that these degeneracies are there, still there, when you go to higher loops. So there must be hidden charges responsible for the degeneracies, and then you construct them. And so that's how it works. So that's how you see that the thing is that's a definition of perturbative integrability. Now, when you truncate the system at three loops, it's not exactly integrable. So once you go beyond one loop, you have to buy the whole package, go to higher and higher loops, because there's always if you commute these charges in three loop level, there's four loop stuff, and so you have to correct them. So the way we define these charges is that the Hamiltonian the charges carry no powers of G squared, it's stripped off. And then really, that's one loop. QR of zero is the Heisenberg charge, the way it's defined here.
This
equation, by zero, is going to really only be up to the four loop.
Yeah. But of course, I mean, now I mean the conjectures. Conjecture extended to infinity, and of course you have to pray that nothing really bad happens at infinity. It's not a construction. We don't have a way to.
My understanding is what you're really proving here is you've constructed some Q of G such that Q commutator Q equals order G to the fourth of something.
Right.
Yeah, but then you can go on to five loops, and then it works even. No, it was done.
Oh, what was done?
Yeah, to five loops. You cannot prove anymore. You cannot prove anymore that it's starting beyond three loop. You cannot prove that it's a gauge theory.
Where does proof end and conjecture start?
I can't tell you exactly, but if you want it to be if it should be valid in court, I'll spend 5 minutes. To put all the little provisions. I can tell you in private. Three loop is completely sure. Originally, we made an assumption. Three loop is proven.
Did you say that was at some loop that there is divergence between gauge theory and C-module?
That we don't know. There could be a problem at four loops because nobody did any, four loop computation in field theory.
Is three-module computation equivalent to gauge theory computation?
I don't know, because once again, to up to three loops, it's really completely sound, as far as I can see. Beyond three loops, it's not sound as far you can claim that you have proven that the spin chain really corresponds to gauge theory, because, once again, no human soul has published anything on four loops for n equals 4.
Okay, but do you actually have a spin chain to all orders in G?
No.
Okay, so maybe this in the box there, it's Q commutator Q equals order G to the n. What is n?
This is a conjecture, which has been proven up to three loops. And
okay, so n is 6 or something?
Yeah, if you want, yeah. And no, but there's two things. Is there a way to construct these models as spin chains, not caring about gauge theory? And then it's established that it sort of works in this perturbative sense up to five loops. Beyond, you see nothing that indicates that there could be a problem at some point, so you kind of believe it, but it's not. You see, what we don't have is that's why I went a little bit through this Fadeev stuff. We don't have a construction of these spin chains.
What is the guiding principle for constructing this type of spin chain without referring to gauge theory? Is there a unique spin chain?
No, there's actually many, but then you have to also impose something you believe, like, well, you should impose integrability at some beyond three loops. That three loop, you can prove it. Beyond three loop, you have to impose it. And you impose this BMN scaling, which may or may not be there. So we know nothing.
Is it manifest somehow? How do you look at that equation?
If you do this perturbative construction, you find undetermined coefficients, and then you can take your pick what you want. Do you want integrability? Do you want BMN? Do you want both?
There's
unknown
stuff. Most general, say, integrable spin chain, which somehow looks like a field theory up to 4 or 5 loops.
But it's not determined. So
there are several
coefficients, and they grow fast. They grow fast, and then there's, like Niklas just insinuated, in fact, there's yet another principle that you have to also put in. There's spin chains, which are integrable in this perturbative sense, have BMN scaling and so on, but cannot come from field theory, because there's certain constraints what the Feynman diagrams can do and not do. For sure that, but there's a little bit more subtle rules also. About the possible types of permutations you can have.
How many fields in the internal?
Yeah.
Which basically you say that since you start having a higher order, you might lose it. Do you have any explanation why?
No, in it's the other way around. In fact, if you want integrability and consistency with field theory, you need these things. They're just really, at three loops, remember, at three loops we still can do something in the gauge theory, and you see that these four spin terms really appear. You need them.
But shouldn't there be some in the end also constraint as you go to the...
That's what I was saying. Of course, in principle, at infinity, something could hit you, but I don't know what. But
do you have any idea of sort of asymptotic in the book, say, and to the higher kind of technology?
Yeah, you can.
These are somehow more constrained than the others, where the one particle is moved by the long.
In fact, you started to discover this.
And this seems to be consistent with the problems.
I see.
So you get some coefficient of the average expansion for free from this. actually you see the square root there.
Right. Yeah, so now actually so now you would like to diagonalize this thing and actually also prove that the S matrix factorizes, which would you know, just having some commuting charges doesn't mean that it's an indication that it's integrable, but it's not necessarily useful. And there's a big step to go from conserved charges to actually diagonalizing the problem and showing that the S matrix factorizes. So then what you can do is, up to three loops, you can embed it in a known integrable spin chain, which seems to be one of the, pretty much the only one actually of this type known, so-called inner-Lemsdorf spin chain. And the nice thing about this model is that it actually... It actually works. I'll show you in a second. The coordinate space beta ansatz works, but this algebraic beta ansatz I don't know how to do because I don't know how to generate the charges. It's not the form charges. So anyway, there's this inner Lemsdorf model. So where some beta ansatz is known, and the problem with the inner Lemsdorf model is that at three loops, it's in principle the Hamiltonian is just of spin type. So you have to play tricks starting from three loops to map it to this gauge spin chain. In fact, you have to add at three loops one of the higher charges of the type of... the higher charges also involve more Pauli matrices. So you have to add another higher charge to the Hamiltonian at three loops to emulate these four spin terms. And then at four loops, you are actually dead as far as inner Lemsdorf is concerned. Because then you can prove that in the inner Lemsdorf model, BMN scaling breaks down.
But you know BMN scaling should break down on the Hill theory side also.
Oh, do we know this? Do we have proof? That's really interesting.
For the contradiction with string theory.
What do you mean? I mean, this is sort of we're getting to the holy. I don't know. I wouldn't want to say here that I believe that BMN scaling breaks down. Yeah, it could happen. We don't know much about solidly about four loops. It could happen, and in fact, because of that, you cannot outrule right now the inner Lemsdorf model. Uh-huh. It could be right. No, we really, that's the thing. I mean, I absolutely convinced that these models we found exist. Absolutely sure. Now, how to construct them, I don't know. And whether they agree really with, really emulate gauge theory, I also don't know. But they say really, I mean, the integrable guys missed some beautiful subject here. I mean, these things exist. So anyway, now you can because inner Lemsdorf diagonalized this problem, you can extract some beta ansatz. And the interesting thing is, it actually the right hand side still looks pretty much like at one loop, but you know this S matrix has the same form, but now the rapidity you have to use is a little bit different. So before we just had the 1/2 cotangent t over 2. And now you have to dress up this is BMN type root for rapidity to get an S matrix for the long range model. And the dispersion law looks like this. And that's actually much less mysterious than this here because you can already see the BMN structure here. Right? That's the eigenvalue of the Laplace. In fact, it's easy to argue that if you want BMN scaling, that you should really use this dispersion law. So. So now, in other sectors, we don't have something like inner Lemsdorf. This was only done for SU2. But actually, you can learn from the way inner Lemsdorf found this beta ansatz how to do it in the other cases, and that's also using an idea of Sutherland, which is called asymptotic beta ansatz. So the idea here is that. It's still, you do a coordinate space beta ansatz, and the interaction falls off in a controlled way. And you can always say that I'm only interested in up to a certain loop order. Beyond that, I'm not interested. And beyond that, in that sense, the particles are free. So what you do, you come in from infinity again with two particles. They are free in that sense. Of course, in actual gate theory, they're never free, but perturbatively, they are now free if you drop things certain starting from a certain loop order. Then, say, they start interacting, even though they might not be particularly close. It depends on the loop order you want to discuss. So then there is a complicated way the wave function dresses up. When they approach, then they scatter. And there's yet another complicated way when they go out, how it modifies. And all this complicated way you can stuff into some factors here of the wave function. But then what you do is then you find the true S matrix by again coming to the asymptotic outgoing region where the particles don't interact anymore to this order and perturbation theory. And then the phase that's left after all these complicated things from approaching and flying apart, that's your S matrix. So that's the way you do it. So you have to disentangle this sort of short-range effect from the actual long-range phase shift. You can do it as long as you have a Hamiltonian. So you can do it in SU2/3. And this way you can construct perturbatively this S matrix. And then you just impose asymptotic beta equations. And the interesting thing is that to this order of perturbation theory, they diagonalize the problem. Which is a little bit non-rigorous, but this is what people use in long-range systems, this is idea of Sutherland. So anyway, this way you get S matrices. Now, in order to write the things you get in P space, momentum space is an incredible mess. It's very messy, very ugly. You don't see anything in momentum space. So now you have to find the right variables. And in the nearest neighbor model, you have to go to the rapidities to get this nice algebraic rational form. So here you have to do something else. And then I don't have quite time to explain it. But again, you take inspiration from string theory, even though the structures are not quite the same. But this gives you some guess about what's a good variable to use to write the equation in a nice way. And this is this x variable, which also figured prominently yesterday. Its continuum version figured prominently in yesterday's talk by Niklas. This is the same x he used. Essentially a discrete version of the KMZX. And you can write now the commuting charges in a nice way in this fashion. And say for SU2, the long-range ansatz with all these roots, all these roots disappear when you use that. And you get, again, something that sort of looks rational. But the funny thing is that you can have something like two spectral parameters, an x plus and an x minus. And this goes away in the KMZ limit, and then you only have one x left. And now the really funny thing is that when you use these x variables and you try to express the mass you find from the perturbative beta ansatz, that it becomes very nice. In fact, up to three loop, you can show that the mass is generated by this simple term. Okay. So that allows you now to go beyond SU2 and start guessing beta equations for the other sectors. And again, the way to do it, so to proceed, is you take some inspiration from string theory because there's some funny relations between S matrices in various sectors, which we come to this in a second. You can see on the string side, and then you just say, okay, the S matrices are a little different. I don't care. This looks like a nice relation. Should be valid in gauge theory. You impose it, and you find beta equations even in sectors where the perturbative beta under doesn't work because you don't have a Hamiltonian. In fact, for SL2, we don't have it beyond one loop. And then you can guess some S matrix that unifies these three sectors in this fashion. And then you can keep going. And let me do it fast because we're really running late. So now you can do the perturbative beta and let's say in this SU1/2 sector, remember excitations, we have one boson, one fermion in the bosonic background. And then, again, it's an incredible mess. You express it in x variables. It becomes really nice. So nice that you start to really believe that it should be true beyond three loops. And in particular, the thing you find, I wrote it in this box, actually satisfies the Young-Baxter equation to all loops. So that's a really strong indication that all these guessing games have some truth to them. And I don't know about the gauge theory, but these models somehow seem to exist. Perturbative asymptotic beta, and that's this procedure I just explained. This. Extracting the S-matrix, getting a mess in momenta, and then trying to write it in a nice fashion. So anyway, then you can run through this nested beta under the technique, as I explained a little bit before, you call it the shorter spin chains. And the funny thing is, once you have this nice S-matrix, it works in exactly the same way at one loop as it works to all loops. The computation is not a bit more complicated. So you find this system of beta equations. Gauge parameters? There are some kind of, the spectrum doesn't depend, there's a certain freedom in this S-matrix, such that the spectrum is not dependent on it. And in fact, if you do the extraction from Niklas SU2/3 Hamiltonian, there's also some kind of free gauge parameters which don't influence the spectrum. And all these, when you do this perturbative beta, and that's all these factors that are supposed to not matter, actually nicely package into these omegas. So you can absorb them and really prove that they don't matter.
In fact, they go away if
you
mind.
You can if you want, for example, a Hermitian system, you can fix it. So anyway, then you keep going, and you can also, now here we don't have a Hamiltonian, but in this, you now try to add the SU2 to this. Again, then we don't have a Hamiltonian anymore, but you can guess the S matrix, it satisfies Young-Baxter, do the nested beta on that. And then you come to beta equation for this system here. And then it becomes, when you try to do it for the whole thing, it becomes still more conjectural in the sense that we don't know yet the S matrix for that. And in fact, since we only know the Hamiltonian in this sector, you could only possibly get it for this and not the full. And when you go beyond this PSU 1,1/2, the things become dynamic. And this, there was a question before. The number of sites is not conserved anymore. And still, now there's all various assumptions to try to get consistent equations. And what's extremely important is what Niklas explained as yesterday, that you know now the continuum equation and the thermodynamic limit with lots of beta roots of spinning strings for the superstring. That is this funny Riemann sheets we showed us yesterday. So you want equations that reproduce that, and you want equations that embed all this stuff we found previously, and you want something that matches with SU2/3. So anyway, that's what it is. And it seems to be. And well, this is the seven equations. Remember, I wrote in a very compact way using the Cartan matrix. Actually, here it's a little funny because what you actually, if you look closely at this, there's now also interactions between roots which are not exactly nearest neighbors. So in some sense, the long-range system also becomes long-range on the Dynkin diagram.
Maybe it's also worth mentioning that these equations you could view as a quantization of the curve that basically. So, you kind of have seven equations, and these are the things that connect that connect to adjacent sheets in the stack of, and the x's are the poles.
Are some of these seven equations built by the PSU224? It's not manifest, but. It's really less fewer than seven equations. No, it's, I mean, these seven equations are because what SU4 is. Right, you might get this fewer in Dirac. I mean, the question is, are there? Oh, yeah. Yes. Structure, of course. that other way, it's math mean.
So the first thing is when you put chi to zero here, of course that's the very first thing you want to come to this one loop beta equation, which are already then the long that's a little unclear how to exactly do, but yeah. So I mean.
So what is the equation for?
What? For the spectrum.
You just write it down.
So, but there are some tests. They agree. Oh, by the way, this thing, of course, this is the gauge equations, and the thing with the algebraic curve is only true to two loops, right? Because of this business about the discrepancy. But actually, yeah. So anyway, in as far as gauge theory is concerned, this is the sort of test you can do, and some of them I already mentioned. And now it's just not clear. It's not excluded, not ruled out, that this thing is actually the exact spectrum, because we don't have a single test. We don't have a field theory test where it breaks down.
So the equivalent to spin for the answer is spin change based on this heuristic that we have planarized, so is there anything more than that? So the motivation for having the spin as a model for the answer is
well, because you do it at one loop, and then you see at higher loops you get still a spin chain picture, but this more than nearest neighbor interaction and so on, and you build up.
Is something that we can derive from gauge theory Kleinman-Bergmann?
To some degree, yeah, to the degree I explained. I mean, with various, in some sectors you can go much further, and others not so far, and yet other sectors not at all for the moment. So.
But I think you're just interested in Hamiltonian.
Well, read it off from where? I don't know the Hamiltonian. We have beta equations, but we don't have a Hamiltonian. Once again. That's the same as before. It just doesn't change. We assume it's the same. Yeah, sure.
Now, can you say anything about the solution?
Yeah, sure. Well, we solved them in some simple cases to check that they work. A short operator, so you use the Hamiltonian when you know it, and you diagonalize it to three loops, so you get some results, some rational numbers, or irrational. Yeah. Well, I sort of wrote a sort of test on here. But they are based on actual solutions of these beta equations. Oh, you mean a high loop test?
Assume you're right, right? I
could, but it doesn't look like you would think from ADCC.
So this disagrees with the ADCC
section. Well, you see, it looks like I'm not going to give the last quarter of my talk, but I mean, I wrote this innocent little sigma here, which is the so-called dressing factor I mentioned earlier. So which actually only sits on the central node of the equation. That's the only place it enters. But that's easy to understand because actually, sort of in terms of this nested beta, and that the physical excitations are described by the central one, and then the shorter spin chains doesn't matter anymore.
So all the rest should be given by the structure. Literally, just one equation.
Yeah. This one place you were mentioning.
So this is this idea about this dressing factor. And in fact, for the moment, also on string side, these things seem to fit everything we know if I choose a sigma appropriately. And that now, can I have five more minutes?
Mm-hmm.
So, shouldn't have said that. So how do you guess now the equations for the string theory? So let's assume that the string theory is also integrable, and that we have a beta ansatz, and hopefully of the same type as we find seem to find in gauge theory, and to some degree find. So then make an assumption that this dispersion law holds. I mean, it gives BMN and so on. As a warning, in Inozemtsev, for example, the dispersion law is not like this. I said this to some people privately, that in the Inozemtsev model, I mean, the actual expression for the energy is not just additive like that. And it, I mean, the funny thing in this integrable model, if you look at this expression, E is given by this, and Q2 is this dispersion law, and L doesn't enter here at all. It's not dependent on L. Now, in the Inozemtsev model, you find that the actual expression for the energy depends explicitly on L.
What is L?
Length of the spin chain. So, but there's two versions of it. Again, a sort of asymptotic model, which on an infinite line, and another one which is really on a circle of length L. And in fact, in Inozemtsev, it's very interesting. It interpolates between the so-called Haldane-Chasky spin chain and the Heisenberg model. So, so anyway, with these assumptions and provisos, you can now see how far you can get by taking the logarithm, as one does when one starts solving the beta equations in such a fashion. And you see this is sort of the free part of the excitation, and then you can work out the leading phase shift due to the S matrix. I mean, the theta is the phase shift associated with the S matrix. And then when you plug the at large L, now let's assume that L is large, and plug the leading approximation for the momenta directly into the S matrix, then you get a prediction once you plug into the dispersion law for the leading deformation of BMN. So this is the BMN piece, so to speak. And this is a leading finite size correction. And the only assumption, once again, I made is the structure assumption is just that there is a beta ansatz. And I assumed some dispersion law. And then, of course, you get it a little more explicitly when you assume this dispersion law.
Just a conjecture.
But I explained this before. This is, I mean, this is our sort of starting point. That's a thing that works up to five loops and is consistent with BMN and so on. I mean,
so there are two separate things. You're right.
There's many separate things.
Equations for P, for example, and then E in terms of P.
Yeah.
Right. So there are two things here.
So anyway, I use the same dispersion law. I make assumptions the same in string and gauge theory. I haven't said yet anything about, this is my whole point. Now, I haven't said anything about S. But now you look at these near BMN computations where this leading shift to BMN was precisely computed. And this allows you from looking, so what you then see is that, in fact, the result they find is precisely in this form of a double sum. And then, assuming the dispersion law, you can extract theta. But you notice that I plugged in here this leading approximation, so you, in general, cannot expect to find with this procedure the exact S matrix. So anyway, when you do that, you find some expressions, and you can do it in various sectors. And actually, the way we did it first was by looking at this KMZ equations, and which is another handle, according to a very similar logic about extracting the phase shift. Then, of course, there that's already a continuum model, so you have to rediscretize. But the two procedures are actually agreeing, the one from near BMN and the one from KMZ. And when you do that, you find precisely the stuff I told you before, these structural things, that there seems to be one global dressing factor. It's all true, known in all, it's true in all known cases. And you find this funny relation I used before when I tried to guess things on the gauge theory side. And then originally, there's some story that we found this with Gleb and Zergy, this factor. actually Niklas then noticed how to express it in these x variables. It doesn't look very appetizing, indicating that maybe in fact that's not the same. And then since a few days ago from this latest paper of Alkali and Niklas, we really know it's not correct. So you actually have to correct this thing to get agreement in the mean, I mean in this 1 over L corrections to KM and Z. But nevertheless, the other structural things are really this, they work. I mean, with addressing factors, as far as we know.
It's in fact
the
rejected phase. It's in a row phase for everything.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so what tests can you make for the ones with the sigma? Before we did tests without the sigma for the gauge theory, now with this addressing factor. Then what we initially checked was that, in fact, this lambda to the 1 force behavior comes in. And it's very interesting that it actually only comes from the dressing factor. The other stuff is subleading. And then, in fact, all this beautiful curve Niklas explained us yesterday, you get when you use this dressing factor and this system of 7 equations, and you come to the continuum KM Z equations. And then, sort of, by construction, of course, it reproduces these near Bm things. There was another test by McLaughlin and Swanson for open strings, which just there's a simple some simple rules how to convert beta equations for closed to open by just doubling up the S matrix somehow. And so they did this in this naive way, and it just worked beautifully. And then, as I told you, that since recently we actually have a little bit more on the fine structure. And this has a little bit of a story with twists and turns, because originally we thought that that there should be corrections, and then there were some results which indicated that maybe it was even exact to all orders in 1 over j, but now we know that the dressing factor really has to be corrected. So I'm concluding. It would be nice to have a few proofs and maybe a construction of these spin chains. Then there really is the question, can we really find now this non-asymptotic spectrum of NX4? And I wrote or proved, because as I said, I don't know that if we got really, really lucky, these equations are already the right ones. But of course, I wouldn't bet. I mean, I would rather think that they should be somehow corrected. And now we should really learn how to actually find beta equations from the sigma model. And then once we've done these two different types of homework, we should just check whether the spectra agree. And this would be a partial proof of the ADS CFT correspondence at n equals infinity. A very interesting question, as we discussed, is whether a beta anthrop even can exist. There's another scenario that there's something more complicated in between, and that beta anthrops of the traditional kind only emerge when you go to strong or weak coupling. And anyway, it should be fairly clear that if we crack this problem, we have a completely new tool for understanding gauge and string duality. And I started out by explaining you that there might be some interesting application to QCD. In fact, you could try to go back. Once you've understood these highest transcendentality things, you can dream of also figuring out some clever ways to find the rest. And I think there's also an independent topic here that I am really, independently of whether this really works the way we envision it, these systems seem to be there, and they should eventually also be of some interest to condensed matter theory. Thanks. Well, that's the thing. Once again, intuition comes from Inozemtsov model, where for the full model at finite L, he found the spectrum, but it doesn't. It looks similar to a beta ansatz, but not quite. And I mentioned that already. That, for example, the energy is not just additive. And the same might happen here. I don't know.
Okay, so thank you very much.